Okay, I think we are on. Cue music. And hi everyone, and welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break. I'm Lahiru.
And I'm Stan.
And today we're going to do another classification or categorization topic with for cardiovascular. How's it going, Stan?
Well, yeah, good. We're still locked down, aren't we?
Yeah, we're still locked down.
Yeah. So from the previous episode, we're locked down, and now this episode, now we're still locked down. Oh my God, when will this end?
Yeah, oh my God, I had a really great weekend planned, so it's a bit sad that now I will be doing this pretty much most of the weekend.
well, I've been so bored, I've picked up an on-call shift on Saturday.
Oh, wow, that's great. Good on you. Well,
yeah, it's booked to, you know, get out of the house, go do something.
That's right.
Otherwise, heal the sick. In.
Hey, you're a better man than me. So Stan, so we're going to go through this, but again, I think people really enjoyed our performance tips. So yeah, what performance tip or interesting thought did you have for this episode?
Look, I was having dinner a couple of weeks ago, just before, you know, all this happened. And, you know, one of the rare events that we were able to go outside Melbourne and actually enjoy the nightlife of Melbourne. And one of the friends that we're out with, you know, he knows Craig Tarley. And so I was having dinner with Craig Tarley, who is the CEO of Tennis Australia. So I was having a chat to him about tennis players and how they have changed over the years. And he said something to me that really resonated with me in terms of how we should approach our study as well. He was saying that, you know, today's tennis players more on the quality of their training than the quantity. And I think that is so important. You know, we've always thought about, you know, the way we study or the way we learn, as in we need to put an X amount of hours in. And that the more hours we put in, the more we're going to get out. But his point was that it's not just about the amount of hours, mm-hmm. but also the quality of hours you put in. And in fact, the focus now should be on the quality rather than the quantity.
I actually recently just started thinking about that. I had this gym membership and I'd go there and I'd just do a couple of reps. And it's so easy for my brain just to say, oh, you don't need to do three sets. Just do a couple, just do a few less reps. It's fine. At least you're here. And so I was like, okay, this just sounds terrible. I don't want to be this person. And so I recently linked back in with my personal trainer, and you know, when I do a session with him, I'm dead at the end of it. It is absolutely that hour is so focused.
Yeah. And you know, and I think that's exactly right. And I think this is why, you know, having that mentor or having that study group or having someone to keep you on your toes, to keep you honest, essentially, really helped with this quality study, this concept of quality study. Because sometimes I think, you know, when we just do it ourselves and we say, you know, look, I've been studying for, you know, X amount of hours. But when you look back, it's not actually quality study. You know, we think we're doing the right quantity, but it's not quality. So, you know, when we talk about quality, you know, we want to be focused, we want to have an aim, and we want to be able at the end to actually complete what we set out to do. And I think that's so important.
And I wonder how to, I know I was pretty guilty of quantity over quality with this exam. You know, I was just so afraid of failing that I just sat down for very unproductive hours trying to get through this. But I think those things that you mentioned were right. Where if you have specific goals, you have a good work rate, that you're accountable to what you're meant to have done that time, and potentially even keeping a logbook and a timetable of what you need to achieve and being happy when you've done it. That is a realistic timetable, because let's face it, every timetable I've ever had, I've always been, you know, behind on it. And I think a lot of us are. But are there any things that you'd suggest to, keep it quality over quantity?
Well, the idea of quality is to make sure that, you know, you have set objectives, mm-hmm. and that you're able to tick off those objectives as you go. It's similar to like when you have a personal trainer. So the reason why a personal trainer works is that they come in with set objectives for you to complete. Whereas, you know, when you do a session yourself, mm-hmm. You're sort of freeballing it, aren't you? You're sort of going, mm-hmm. yeah, I'll do these set of reps, or I'll do, you know, this amount. And you tend to be a lot more forgiving to yourself in terms of, oh, look, you know, look, I don't want to push anymore. You know, I think I've done enough, or I'll just do it within that same amount of time. Whereas when you've got that PT there, they're telling you, I want, you know, this amount of reps now. And it's the same with, you know, being in a study group, or having that relationship with that mentor. It sort of tells you, look, we want this to be done in this amount of time. And that's what we need to do to complete this task. And I think that's what it is about quality. It's like having that ability to focus and that ability to complete the task in the time allotted, rather than sort of, you know, do it, you know, sort of freeballing it, but doing it over maybe twice or three times as long. So the idea of, you know, object of keeping it focused and keeping it high quality, make sure that every session of study that you do, you have an objective and you have a time and you have that sense that during that time, this is what you're going to do to achieve this objective. So, you know, if you've got a learning objective, you know, tied in with a short answer question, and then, you know, like maybe read a past question, understand it, and then write an answer to it. And, you know, just have that closed loop. And that is what I would call sort of quality study.
That sounds really good.
All right. So now we're going to go ahead and talk about more categories, because this is such a popular topic, but this one is a really important one. It's about cardiovascular categories.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is quite a big one. And you've got a really good set of topics here with a good amount of categorization. So, are you happy to start?
Yeah. Let's go. So, I mean, I thought obviously cardiovascular is, you know, as a bigger topic as respiratory, and so crucial to our day-to-day anesthetic practice. And so a lot of these things I think about, again, they're really relevant. The stuff I learned for my first part exam, I still think about now. And I still think about, especially in those crisis moments where, you know, you're trying to problem solve various cardiovascular problems, whether it's hypertension or ischemia or whatever it is. And I think if you learn this stuff really well now, I think you'll make you a better anesthetist, because you'll be able to get to problem solving with far more rigor. And hopefully speed as well. So the first one is hypotension. Now, how do you classify hypotension? And I remember one of the fantastic educators at Monash, Craig Noonan, he would always, you know, drill into us. For him, it's preload, rate, rhythm, contractility, and afterload. And I've always used that. So anytime someone's hypotensive, I have this system where I'm thinking, well, it's most likely this. I'm really concerned about these factors. But really, if I'm wrong from the probability gambit and the serious things I need to rule out, I will have a categorization of preload, rate, rhythm, and contractility, and afterload, and I'll just, you know, check things off as I go with that. Is that similar for you, Stan?
That's really good, and I really like how you've categorized it, and as well as sort of thinking about it when that happens, because when a patient is hypotensive, it's not, you know, the most. Most trainees will think about, volume, won't they?
Mm.
Well, they either think about volume or they'll think about afterload. Mm. So, in fact, what they'll often give when someone is hypotensive is that they'll give someone metaraminol. Mm. But you know that from your from the categorization that you've done, it's more than just afterload. It's also preload as well. So making sure that they're adequately volumed. So it's not just metaraminol that you need to give, but you also need to think about, are they adequately volume? Because if they're not adequately volume, metaraminol is not going to do much, is it? Or it's only going to be sort of a very temporizing measure.
Exactly. It'll fudge the numbers for a little bit, but the cardiac output is falling.
Yes, correct.
So
correct.
This may actually seem quite confusing to a lot of people. You know, there's quite a few things here: preload, rate, rhythm, contractility, and afterload. But it does lend itself to being really effective for me. For example, preload, you know, is there obvious bleeding, or does the patient naturally need some volume because they're dehydrated? And if they've had anesthesia, they probably, you know, need a 500 ml bolus at the induction in most cases, unless they have some severe cardiac disease. But that's easy to diagnose and easy to treat. And if I'm really worried about occult bleeding, I take a HB. I can even check the pulse pressure variation. If it's above, you know, say 12, I'd be concerned. Now, rate is easy. I just look at the heart rate or the sats rate. The rhythm is easy. I just look at the ECG strip. If it's not sinus rhythm, I'm definitely worried that atrial fibrillation or any other malignant rhythms will seriously decrease cardiac output and then cause hypotension. Contractility, you know, that's pretty much, is the heart muscle contracting and having a really good ejection fraction just from its innate ability to contract. And then afterload, is there any kind of dilation? And anesthesia is the most common thing in our situation for this, but is it anaphylaxis? Is it some kind of distributive shock, like septic shock? And I can go through all of these very simply. Now, one of the things, as you mentioned, was the reflex for us is we get hypertension. It is most likely due to a bit of vasodilation from the anesthetic or a bit of extra anesthetic that we've given to a young patient potentially. And so Aramine is the right choice. But when you think about this, if you do have a person who has is undergoing some kind of myocardial ischemia, so now their contractility has decreased, you know, you'd be correct to give a bit of metaraminol and fix afterload. But then at a certain point, if you are not fixing that problem and repeat metaraminol boluses aren't working, you've got to start thinking that there's something else going on. And persisting with a if you persist at something in spite of repeated failure, that really is a problem. So maybe really it is contractility that I need to address, or preload that I need to address. And ephedrine at that point is the right temporizing measure as I start assessing, is this patient having an ischemic event? So I really love to hang all of my classification on this system because it really allows me to not make that mistake.
Yep. And look, the other thing that I think about also is, with regards to rate. Mm-hmm. So there is a difference in how I think about it in terms of if a patient is bradycardic and hypotensive mm-hmm. versus tachycardic and hypotensive. And rate and preload are somewhat similar, because the way that I think about it is that if you're bradycardic, mm-hmm. you've actually got a longer filling time. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, not always, but most of the time, your preload should be okay if you've got bradycardia. And so the idea that you're bradycardic and hypotensive, for me, would lend itself more to an afterload issue or more to a contractility issue. And that's where I think about probably more ephedrine mm-hmm. or metaraminol, but also being aware that using metaraminol can actually worsen the bradycardia as well through the
baroreceptor.
the baroreceptor reflex, correct. Whereas, someone who's tachycardic and hypotensive, that tells me that, they're not getting enough preload because there's not enough filling time. Mm-hmm. And that could also be an issue that they're under volume, which is why their heart is compensating with a higher heart rate. So for me, someone who is tachycardic and hypotensive, I will tend to probably fill them a little bit more mm-hmm. before, as well as using some metaraminol as well. And then just seeing what the effect of metaraminol does, whether it actually has a sort of an effect to the baroreceptor reflex. Because if they're well filled, you'll actually see their heart rate come down as the blood pressure increases. Mm-hmm. But if they're underfilled, you actually see minimal difference.
Yeah, I think that probably happens in that trauma setting where you have just increasing metaraminol requirements, but just a steady tachycardia regardless yep. of how much aramine you
correct.
Give.
Yeah. Correct.
Now, so with this classification, obviously there's many ways you can classify. So some people do use the shock classification, which is hypovolemia, hypovolemic shock, cardiogenic shock, distributive shock, or obstructive shock. But I found that doesn't naturally allow me to think of rate and rhythm as some of my differentials. But again, once you get used to whatever classification or system that you use, it's something that you can repeat and make very practical for your situation. The next one is oxygen supply and demand. And I find that, again, when I'm thinking about the heart, a lot of the times the problems of the heart really leads to this equation or this balance. So, why does someone become ischemic? It's all oxygen supply demand. And when I think about that, that's how I think about not only the cause, but also the treatment. So if we go into that for a bit more detail, so the fact that your muscle, your heart muscle, or any organ in the body is alive is because supply is more than demand or meets demand. And as soon as that imbalance is there, that's when you get ischemia. So supply is really just oxygen flux or oxygen delivery to the heart. And that's a function of oxygen content times the blood flow or the coronary blood flow in this circumstance. Now to break that down a bit further, oxygen content is a function of how much hemoglobin you have and how that combines to oxygen, so your saturation level, and then to a lesser extent, your PO2 and any dissolved oxygen. So if you multiply that content by the flow, you get the amount of oxygen that will be delivered to your heart muscle or any other organ. Now, when we think about the other factors to think about, you also have to then think about the coronary vascular resistance and the coronary perfusion pressure, because that's what will really determine flow. So if you think of like a modified Ohm's law, flow will be dependent on the change in pressure over the resistance. Now we can then break down resistance again. So I'm just trying to step through all the different parts of trying to make this make sense, I guess. So coronary vascular resistance will be determined by metabolic factors, myogenic factors, so these are autoregulation type factors, neural factors such as the sympathetic nervous system's involvement, physical compression, especially important with the heart where the left ventricular contraction can cause occlusion of intraventricular vessels. Then you've got the viscosity of the blood and also other pathological things like atherosclerosis. Now I think about coronary perfusion pressure in that equation. So again, we go back to flow will be determined by change in perfusion, so change in pressure over resistance. So we've gone through the resistance factors, and then the coronary perfusion factors really depends on the coronary pressure at the start of your artery minus the right atrial pressure or the left ventricular pressure, depending on what part of the systole or diastole you're in. So that's pretty much my basic understanding of supply and how I can attach it to various equations and different categories. So just to reiterate, cerebral blood flow times oxygen content is your flux. Your cerebral blood flow is dependent on change in perfusion pressure over, your change in pressure over the resistance, and then the resistance and coronary perfusion pressure both have factors that can be varied. Now, the next part of that is oxygen extraction. So we all know that the heart has a very high basal extraction. It's of 55 to 65%, with other tissues only being about 25%. So already it's maximally extracting oxygen. Oxygen demand is really met by increasing this coronary blood flow rather than increasing extraction, which might be available to other organs. So yeah, that's how I think of supply. This equation will probably help in many other circumstances, whether it's your other organs or other tissue beds as well. What do you reckon, Stan?
I think that's really good. I think what you've set out is clear, and I think that framework sort of works well. And I think this has been a short answer question in the past, isn't it?
It refers to either aortic stenosis or tachycardia. So depending on what that context is, you can kind of change these variables to suit either heart rate increase or aortic stenosis and how that affects it.
And I think to sort of expand on that, I think you've got something on demand as well, because supply is always matched with demand, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So demand for this, so it really depends on the inherent metabolic rate of the heart and the myocardial work. So if I think of metabolic rate, it probably depends on a few things. So what is the cell using? So it probably has a lot of genetic components to it and just some demographic components. But then things that can change will be the energy of electrical activation, the type of work that's exerted. So pressure work takes more energy than volume work. The basal rate of work, so the basal metabolic rate, and also wall thickness. And you can imagine how this could change based on the pathology. For example, if there's a tachycardia, you have more electrical energy for electrical activation. If you have aortic stenosis, you have more pressure work than volume work. Whereas if you have a dilated heart, you'll have more volume work, which is takes less energy. As well as aortic stenosis and other pathologies, hypertension can increase wall thickness. So suddenly you have a muscle that innately needs more energy. So those were my wall thickness, basal rate, type of work, and electrical activation factors. Myocardial work, now you'll see how this relates back to the previous framework. So myocardial work can be dependent on wall tension, which is essentially preload and afterload, contractility, heart rate, and the inherent rhythm of the heart. So the wall tension will increase with increased preload, increased afterload, and may even depend on something like Laplace's law that you can invoke and change the variables for that. If something has more contractility based on the sympathetic nervous system or other factors, again, increases work. heart rates or tachycardia increases work as well. And, you know, the other thing with tachycardia is that when you have a tachycardia, you also have a decreased diastolic filling time. So now you have decreased supply as well. So increasing the work and decreasing the supply in a tachycardia can be very detrimental, especially with someone who has atherosclerotic disease, which makes it far more risky for them. And then,
which is why, beta blockers are theoretically used in these patients to reduce the tachycardia and to increase the diastolic time to increase oxygen supply.
That's right,
and also reduce demand as well.
Yeah, it's kind of that miracle drug, really, isn't it? Put people on beta blockers in the long term, and you have increased survival benefit. But we don't really do that in the short term, as found out in a couple of studies.
That's right. But, at the same time, it's one of those catch-22 things because, a lot of patients have tachycardia for a reason. They've got a tachycardia because they've got increasing oxygen demand of the body. And it's one of those things where, it's the body's natural response to increase the cardiac output to meet the oxygen demand. But if you start using beta blockers, it actually prevents that. So
that's right. So it's almost like the septic patient. This is one of those conundrums. Say you have a septic patient. They have a tachycardia, and they're hypotensive. But that hypotension is not due to a contractility problem, or a problem with filling time. It's really due to distribution or preload and afterload factors. So the solution to that is really volume and noradrenaline or some kind of vasopressor. If you were to give this patient a beta blocker, that would be stopping the patient's inherent, coping mechanism for their hypertension and their sepsis, septic picture. But if you take that same circumstance and then put in, someone who now is septic but has ischemia, that becomes a very tricky problem. It becomes a bit of a dilemma. Now you have someone whose body is trying to support their blood pressure with a tachycardia, but that tachycardia is now compromising the heart function as well. And that's where it can get very tricky. Now, as we're talking about tachycardia and, myocardial oxygen supply and demand and appropriate tachycardias and inappropriate tachycardias, you might get that circumstance where someone has some kind of ischemic heart disease or a risk of ischemic heart disease and has a tachycardia due to pain. And so in that circumstance, this tachycardia is due to the increased sympathetic nervous system response to pain. So really, being able to, that tachycardia isn't actually treating the pain. It really is as a result of the pain and also now compromising the heart. So in that circumstance, obviously you'd want to have this, say post-operative patient with really well analgesed. But if for whatever reason you weren't able to analgese, it would make sense to treat this patient, trying to decrease their heart rate, especially if it was causing ischemic symptoms.
Well, it's one of those challenging things, isn't it? Mm. So, if you've got a patient with known ischemic heart disease where you're going to be intubating them and that intubation is quite stimulating. Mm. And, we talk about techniques in terms of managing their blood pressure, prior to intubation. Like what are some of your techniques that you would use or that you use in your practice to mitigate the sympathetic response to laryngoscopy in these patients?
I think that's definitely a first part question, if not a part one question as well. So what I'll do is essentially ensure that you've got everything on board for an appropriate intubation. So having enough propofol, so enough hypnotic agent so the patient isn't aware of something like that. Having appropriate analgesia. So often would use alfentanil or high-dose fentanyl for those very critical circumstances and potentially something else. So after using good opioids and good medications for analgesia that are fast-acting and effective, I would then also use potentially something else if that may not be enough. For example, I might have Esmol already or phentolamine ready or even lignocaine to spray or lignocaine intravenously. So something extra. And then finally, my technique, I'd make sure it's as least stimulating as possible. So I might use a video laryngoscope. I might not try to really get the tip of the laryngoscope stimulating the valvular as much as normal, and just get an adequate view that I could pass the tube in as effectively as possible. If I didn't need to use a bougie, I wouldn't. So I think I'd probably address those factors as best as possible. Adequate hypnotic, adequate analgesia, good soft technique that's not stimulating, and then prepare for the increased stimulation with other pharmacological agents such as Esmol, phentolamine, lignocaine. And I think that's probably what I'd do. Yeah.
I mean, and look, with the hypnotics, that's one of the challenging things is that you don't want to give too much, do you? Because if you give too much,
that's right.
The patient becomes hypotensive, and then that disturbs the oxygen supply with regards, you know, to their fixed stenosis, because it's not something that they can compensate by dilating. So, yeah, use of opioids is good. And, you know, like with the opioids that you use, like, do you use fentanyl or L-fentanyl for these patients?
If I really, if I really am concerned about tachycardias, I'd probably use L-fentanyl or remifentanyl. But that said, a lot of the time for these cardiac inductions where I kind of want everything as stable as possible, you know, actually there's probably two kinds of inductions. The inductions where I want everything as stable as possible, where I really don't want hypertension or hypotension, I'd probably use big dose fentanyl and, you know, midazolam and just a very slow induction, turning on the volatile and running aramine at the same time with ephedrine ready. So I'd have everything kind of ready, outline in, so I'm just managing it second by second. But then if I've got those situations where I really, really care about hypertension, but I don't think hypotension will cause that much of a detriment in the short term, such as severe preeclamptic patient for a GA, or maybe a younger patient having a subarachnoid bleed for a clipping. I care far more about increased hypertension or high blood pressure causing a rupture, intracranial bleed. That's far worse for this patient than a bit of hypotension. In that case, I'd probably use bigger dose of alfentanil or remifentanil because I just want it to be acting really quickly. How about yourself, Stan?
Well, I think you made the point about laryngoscopy. And I think one of the tricky things that I find is that every patient's different. So, and you know, you can sort of tell us about your experiences, but, you know, with regards to using, you know, big dose fentanyl or big dose L-fentanyl, I'm going to be honest with you, I've used multitude of techniques, you know, high dose opioids, beta blockers, and I think the mainstay is you just got to do gentle laryngoscopy just to see how they respond. Because
I think I agree with you.
Yeah. You know, I've used those things before. And then, you know, I've had, you know, during the process of laryngoscopy, you see their blood pressure shoot up still.
Yeah.
Whereas some patients are good. Some patients, you know, you see them, you know, you do what's called, you know, the perfect anesthetic where their blood pressure is 120 all the way through. But then you get some patients where despite all these techniques that you do during laryngoscopy, it's very embarrassing. You see the blood pressure sort of shoot up to 180, 200 systolic, and you're like, well, thank God it's not a real.
It's one of those things maybe where, hey kids, drugs aren't the answer. Technique is the answer.
I think, yeah, you're right. I think it's all about technique. It's all about making sure that you do it gently. And I think the other key thing is also making sure that you've got adequate muscle relaxation on board, because that's the other big thing is that if you attempt too early without adequate muscle relaxation, patients do respond to it. Whereas, you know, good muscle relaxation and then attempting it, you know, in a stepwise process just to sort of see how they respond. And I think that would be sort of the technique that I would use. And you're right.
Yeah, I agree. High dose rock. I didn't mention it before, but absolutely, this is all about the anesthetic triad, having everything at the right level, the normal level, giving you a big dose of rock to make sure it's acting appropriately, giving a decent dose of propofol, and then enough analgesia that would be reasonable. But yeah, I think you're right. If you've got a difficult airway, no matter what you do, no matter how much anesthetic you give, they're going to have a sympathetic response because it's such a stimulating procedure.
It is very stimulating. Yeah, even, you know, 500 of fent in a 50 kilogram person, you think that should be more than enough, you know, to ablate their laryngoscopy response. I've seen it still go up. So
yeah,
no guarantees. But if you do it sequentially and do it measuredly, that's the key thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, all right.
So the next thing. Now we've come up to. Sorry, I'll start again. So before I go, so I've got to go at 3:30. So we might just kind of go till about 3:30, and then kind of go for the next few in the next couple of in the next episode.
Yeah, maybe? I think so.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, I'll go through. Yeah, I think we can go through coronary blood flow and coronary vascular resistance if we do that. So the next topic here is determinants of coronary vascular resistance. So really, a lot of times we invoke Ohm's law. So resistance equals a pressure difference over flow, which in this circumstance is coronary perfusion pressure over coronary blood flow. And often we will invoke then Poiseuille's equation. So 8 eta L or 8 NL, it roughly looks like, but it's the Greek letter eta over pi r to the power 4. And so in this equation, the most important thing by far is the radius. So when we think of the radius as it applies to this, there's so many factors that could change the radius of your coronary vessels. And these can be neural factors, chemical factors, autoregulation, metabolic or myogenic, and then physical factors such as compression, such as in the cardiac cycle and systole, you get compression of those vessels, heart rate as well as pathology such as atherosclerosis and anything else. So I find that just having that as a, you'll often have to refer to the determinants of coronary vascular resistance. So just having that kind of format, that kind of framework will be really useful. So coronary vascular resistance is pressure difference over flow, which is coronary perfusion pressure over coronary blood flow. And then you can roughly equate that to the Haugen-Poiseuille equation, 8 eta L over pi r 4. And then, you know, we've talked about radius, but you could also talk about eta being viscosity and how that can change in your blood depending on the depending on the hematocrit, the viscosity of blood as well.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Excellent.
I think that's a really good, clear way to sort of think about this. Mm-hmm. And it really sort of allows you to sort of think about ways that you can reduce coronary vascular resistance.
True.
Yep.
So the next one that really can leads on from this is coronary blood flow. So, you know, again, we've mentioned it previously with the oxygen supply demand, but coronary blood flow equals coronary perfusion pressure over coronary vascular resistance. And we've already talked about the fact that these are neural factors, physical factors, so compression in the cycle, in the cardiac cycle, heart rate, viscosity, and then autoregulation. And a bit more about autoregulation, often it's metabolic, where there's all these different factors that can be released in the, you know, capillary bed that can cause, so say there is a problem with decreased perfusion, you might have increased potassium and pH, decreased pH, increased hydrogen ions, increased potassium, nitric oxide release, and that dilates these vessels, which allows more blood flow, as well as the myogenic autoregulation mechanism, which this is a response that you'll often have to quote in this exam and refers to many different vascular beds, but it refers to the intrinsic tendency of vascular smooth muscle to contract in response to increasing pressure and to relax in response to decreased distending pressure. I thought that was just a good way to just remind everyone that a really good way of just summarizing a lot of this is these pretty simple equations. And in the cardiac context, you'll be repeating this time and time again.
Fantastic.
Good.
So I think we're going to wrap up, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's enough for now. So the next time we'll do this, we might talk a bit about, you know, the body's compensation for loss of 1 liter of fluid or a liter of blood, and just, you know, the, I guess, immediate, intermediate term and longer term effects of this and how the body compensates. And that's kind of a bigger topic. So we can talk about how we could easily just classify that. And that really spans so many things, such as the, you know, the neurohormonal mechanisms that exist all the way from, you know, your nerve reflexes, your cardiac, as well as your renal compensation systems and further from that as well. So I think that's a pretty good place to end. And we'll come back with some more of the categorization as well as some more short answer questions that we'll go through and try to give it a clinical context.
Look forward to the next episode. Sounds exciting.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Stan. So, thanks very much for listening. Please share with anyone who might be interested. And we'll catch you next time.